The following is a Reels Channel and Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and PodcastOne.com.
You know that's the sound of another sale on your online Shopify store. But did you know Shopify powers selling in person, too? That's right. Shopify is the sound of selling everywhere. Online, in-store, on social media, and beyond. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/truecrime.
This program contains graphic violence and sexual situations. Viewer discretion is advised.
In the 1970s, a young woman appears on a televised dating show. The answers from one dashing bachelor pique her interest.
Charismatic, great smile, obviously an intelligent guy.
What she doesn't know is that Bachelor number one is a cold-blooded killer. On the outside, he appears to be a charming man with a penchant for photography. But on the inside, he's a wolf in sheep's clothing.
Do you girls mind if I take your picture?
He's a devil. He's a devil himself.
Through the lens of his camera, he focuses on his next victims.
He was the perfect predator.
Need a ride to school?
He could disarm a woman. They'd fall for his charms, never sense that they were in any danger.
He takes not only their photos, but their lives.
Unspeakable brutality, psychopathic stalking, and killing his prey as if they were animals.
He liked to watch the light of life go out of their eyes. And then he would release and bring them back, only to do it again. And while he was sexually assaulting them and torturing them.
He got away with doing that, so he did it again and again and again.
He slips through the hands of law enforcement again and again and stalks new prey. Meet Rodney Alcala, a.k.a. the dating game killer.
He's your classic psychopath.
A charismatic and highly eligible bachelor. Until murder made him famous. During the 1970s, Rodney Alcala killed numerous women in a string of sexual murders. Police uncover hundreds of photos taken by Alcala that point to many more potential victims.
Chief Deputy District Attorney Matt Murphy.
Rodney Alcala is one of the most prolific serial killers probably in the history of the United States.
Hey, and welcome to the dating game.
Alcala brazenly appeared as a contestant on a popular game show in 1978.
Senior crime reporter Steve Helling.
Many people know the murderer as the dating game killer.
Retired detective Steve Hodell.
When I saw that video and I'm watching, I said, no, she's not going to pick him.
So I'll take one.
Number one. That's your number one. All right.
And I thought, oh, my God.
Say hello to Rodney Alcala. Rodney, come on and say hello.
Rodney Alcala, loved Rodney Alcala. He was the classic psychopathic narcissist.
Rodney, thank you.
By the time Alcala appeared on the dating game, he had murdered a number of women and served prison time for the brutal rape and attempted murder of an 8-year-old girl. He was a registered sex offender, but the producers of the show didn't conduct a thorough criminal background check.
Prosecutor Gina Satriano.
I have prosecuted serious sex offenders and child molesters for over 20 years, some of the worst of the worst. But this is the one time I can say I really looked into the eyes of evil.
In the years since, books, magazine articles, and television programs have examined the complicated life of Alcala and his sadistic, sexually brutal killings. Over the years, Alcala took hundreds of photographs. Authorities uncovered a stash of images secreted away in a storage locker.
Potentially, I believe there are dozens of murders that Rodney committed that have not been tied to him yet.
The haunting collection of photographs still baffles law enforcement. Police search relentlessly for clues that would reveal who the victims in the Alcala photos are and what happened to them. And the clues are as mysterious as the monster who took the pictures. Born in 1943, Rodney Alcala comes from a middle-class family with roots in both San Antonio, Texas, and Mexico.
He mostly attends Catholic schools. He's bilingual, and he excels academically.
While living in Mexico, young Rodney's beloved grandmother passes away. It is unclear what impact this death has on him. His family life also changes when his parents separate. He and his siblings eventually moved to Los Angeles with their mother.
He was raised by his mom. He grew up in a clean house. He wasn't abused by anyone. He's one of these guys that really had every advantage. He had a girlfriend. He was a cross-country letterman. He was on the yearbook committee. He's kind of your all-American boy.
After graduating high school, Alcala joins the United States Army in 1961. And enters a training program in North Carolina.
An IQ test measures his intelligence at over 140. That's nearly genius level.
Alcala is only in the Army for a short time before he suffers from what appears to be a mental breakdown.
Years into Alcala's stint in the U.S. Army, his mother's cooking dinner one night and she looks up and there's Rodney.
Marie?
No. It's me, Mom.
Rodney!
He has gone AWOL and hitchhiked all the way from Fort Bragg, North Carolina to Los Angeles, California.
Rodney had always been an intelligent, polite young man, and so this wasn't normal behavior to him. He'd never been in trouble before.
After Alcala turns himself in to military authorities, an Army psychologist suggests hospitalization for psychiatric treatment.
A military psychiatrist evaluated Rodney and found that he had a strong antisocial personality disorder.
His commanding officer wrote a review of Rodney Alcala that was prophetic. This is a selfish man who manipulates others, who's only driven by his own need, his own personal gain. He really kind of laid out the psychology of Rodney Alcala very early.
Since Alcala's condition prevents him from performing his military duties, he is discharged from the Army in 1964. Socially, he appears to be friendly, even charming.
According to a diagnostic test, a person with a personality disorder may not be antisocial. They may appear socially normal.
Rodney enrolls in the UCLA School of Fine Arts to pursue his dream of becoming a photographer.
Alcala graduated from UCLA in 1968 with a Bachelor of Fine Arts degree, and he was an honor student.
It's the fall of 1968. Rodney Alcala drives down Sunset Boulevard in Hollywood, California.
Tally Shapiro was a young, pretty girl living in Hollywood with her parents. She was going to public school.
Need a ride to school? Come on in, I'll give you one.
I'm sorry, but I'm not allowed to talk to strangers.
Tally Shapiro knew she shouldn't talk to strangers, but unfortunately, Rodney tricked her.
And he said, "It's okay, I know your parents." He charmed her to the point where she thought, well, if he knows my parents, everything must be okay. And we talked her into getting into the car.
A motorist, Donald Haynes, witnesses the scene as it unfolds and is immediately suspicious. So he follows them to Rodney's apartment.
And he sees them get out of the car and walk in to the apartment. And he thought, this doesn't look right. So he calls the police and he says, hey, there's this guy. He went in with a little girl. I don't know. Black and White responds from Hollywood. They get their door knock it.
I just got out of the shower. Give me a second.
Open the door now or I'm going to kick it in.
When they hear a pained moan, the officers spring into action.
They kick the door. In they go. And he's gone out the back.
The police find Tally Shapiro being choked by a metal bar Alcala has placed across her neck in an attempt to kill her. They quickly remove it and try to save her life.
He actually took an 8-year-old girl walking to school. He raped her and almost killed her. And the police officer, of course, that responded had a choice between save the little girl or catch the bad guy running out the back door. And he saved the little girl.
I need an ambulance down here now. I have an injured child at 836 DeLong Per Avenue. Hurry. Just hold on, sweetie.
As a prosecutor, we prosecute a lot of bad actors, people who do a lot of bad things. I don't think all criminals are evil, but this man is evil.
They rush her to the hospital. They're able to save her life. Obviously, this is not a whodunit. We know this is his place. We've got all of his stuff.
Detectives find cameras, tripods, and dozens of photos of young girls. They also find the UCLA student ID of Rodney Alcala.
Rodney had vanished, so police started an exhaustive investigation. They were trying to get an idea of who Rodney Alcala really was.
LAPD Detective Steve Hodell leads an exhaustive search for the elusive photographer. He starts by interviewing people who knew Alcala at UCLA.
And we're shaking doors and checking all last known addresses, and he's just disappeared. He's vanished. Talked to one of his professors at UCLA. And I said, we're looking for Rodney Alcala. He was a student of yours. We've got a felony warrant out for child molestation and assault, attempted murder. And the professor says, you got the wrong man. He says, Alcala was one of my best students. He wouldn't hurt a fly.
Both faculty and students at UCLA say they like Alcala. No one has anything derogatory to say about him. And no one knows where he is. Rodney Alcala has disappeared. But he soon resurfaces in the last place anyone would expect.
Police!
1968. Rodney Alcala is on the run after the rape and attempted murder of young Tally Shapiro.
After he beat and raped an 8-year-old girl, Rodney Alcala moved to New York and started living under the alias of John Berger.
With a fake ID, Alcala enrolls in New York University Film School as an undergraduate.
One of his professors was Roman Polanski, who had just directed Rosemary's Baby. In a tragic twist, Roman Polanski would lose his wife, Sharon Tate, and their unborn child the very next year at the hands of followers of Charles Manson.
Alcala was a monster, but a monster with a pretty face and a nice smile and charm and intelligence.
Airline stewardess Cornelia Crilly becomes a victim of Rodney Alcala during his time in New York. Police find her brutalized, raped, and strangled body in June of 1971. Meanwhile, her murderer works at a New Hampshire children's art camp as a counselor under the alias John Berger.
Here's a guy who's on the run for raping and beating an 8-year-old child. And now he's got a job working with children. That's messed up.
Fantastic work, ladies. You're both so talented.
LAPD Detective Steve Hodell has not given up on the chase for Alcala. And he convinces the FBI to put Rodney on its 10 most wanted list. Posters go up in post offices everywhere, including the small town in New Hampshire where Alcala is working as a camp counselor.
Amazingly, a couple of teenage girls on a rainy afternoon in New Hampshire go to the post office and they're looking at the FBI wanted posters.
Ooh, FBI's most wanted. Look at this one. She looks just like our camp counselor.
And no doubt about it. So the FBI are called, but he's arrested.
Alcala has been using the alias of John Berger, and he tries to disassociate himself from his true identity.
She was just a little girl. I mean, how could you do such a thing?
I don't want to talk about Rod Alcala and what he did.
I get a phone call saying, he's in custody. Come and get him.
Detective Hodell escorts Alcala back to Los Angeles to be prosecuted in the Tally Shapiro case.
He's pretty quiet the whole flight, but he's still putting on this charming demeanor, as if he doesn't have a care in the world. You know, this is all a big mistake. This guy is smooth, calm, collected, you know, as if he doesn't have a worry in the world. So we get back, we take him in, book him, and start the process.
But there's a problem. The family has moved to Mexico. That's their way of escaping what had happened.
With the Shapiros out of the country, prosecutors arrange a plea bargain. As a result, Alcala gets a sentence of 1 year to life in prison.
In 1974, after less than 3 years in prison, a psychiatrist evaluates Rodney Alcala and finds him to be significantly improved. So he's released after 34 months for beating and raping an 8-year-old girl.
They could have kept him in for life, but after 2.5 years, a psychologist said that he no longer posed a danger to women or children.
In a way, it doesn't surprise me because he was such a smooth talker. Not only does he manipulate 8-year-olds and young women, but men too. I mean, he just had that ability. And I could see him giving the shrink all of the right answers.
Looking at that now, in retrospect, I don't know what they were thinking, but by releasing Rodney Alcala, it resulted in literally probably dozens of people losing their lives in the most horrific way possible.
Once he's free, Alcala uses his hobby to meet potential victims.
This was his thing. He was driving around. He was, hey, I'm a photographer. I'd like to take pictures of you. It was part of his ruse. It was a part of who Rodney Alcala was. It was all about photographs.
Photography is how Alcala meets his next victim, Ellen Hover.
Ellen Hover was also the goddaughter of both Sammy Davis Jr. and Dean Martin.
While on a visit to New York, Rodney kills the socialite in July 1977. Her body will not be discovered for months. Rodney returns to Los Angeles, where in late 1977, Jill Barcombe from Oneida, New York, has recently arrived.
Brother of Jill Barcombe, Bruce Barcombe.
She was technically a teenage runaway, I guess you would consider her that. She was young, and it was the 70s, and she was not making the best decisions. It was probably with 2 months before she crossed paths with this infamous killer.
She was 18 years old, so she was very young to be out in Los Angeles on her own. She had gotten caught up in the prostitution world.
She was an extremely attractive girl, so I'm sure she caught his eye.
And we believe that he picked her up on Hollywood Boulevard while she was working.
Looking for a ride?
Depends who's driving.
Just a nice guy who wouldn't mind having a cute girl in his car.
Could have used his ruse of photography, we don't know that, but that would make sense, and drive her up into the Franklin Canyon Drive in the Hollywood Hills to a remote area off of a dirt road. He incapacitated her in some way, like he did, often with some sort of a blunt force trauma.
No!
Some blow to the head to knock her out so he could control her. He had 3 ligatures on her. He had a nylon stocking, a belt, and a pant leg from her pants that she was wearing. He was pulling so hard, probably bringing her in and out of consciousness like he liked to do, to watch the light of life go out of their eyes and then come back, because that's his way to control and see the control. They probably broke, and he had to go not through one, not through two, but through 3 different ligatures to gain the control he wanted to gain over her and to continue to torture her as he sexually assaulted her and dominated her. She fought back very bravely. And what he did to her was completely disfigure her face down into her bones with that rock.
Please!
Such that her brother describes how she was almost unrecognizable.
You know, there's murder, there's rape, there's murder and rape, and there's the unequivocal carnage of his style, murder and rape. He was animalistic and brutal. And what was ultimately taken from her was not only her life, but her ability to turn her life around. That's really the travesty in that, because she was a beautiful human being. Heart, mind, spirit.
The next morning, on November 10th, 1977, LAPD officers respond to a call about a dead body. They soon discover Jill Barcombe's corpse off Mulholland Drive.
Because he lived in the neighborhood where the body was found, Marlon Brando was even questioned by police.
In 1977, police are trying to connect the murder cases of 11 women whose bodies are discarded on the hillsides of L.A.
Jill Barcombe's murder had a lot of similarities to those of the Hillside Strangler. She'd been found naked, and she was beaten, tortured, sexually molested, and strangled.
Jill Barcombe's body is posed, which becomes a critical clue for police.
He left her posed, as we believe he did with all of his victims, posed in a way that we believe he took photographs of them after they were dead.
Soon, Rodney Alcala will expand his hunting grounds from the highways and byways of Los Angeles to the airwaves of national television.
Murder Made Me Famous. We'll be back after a word from our sponsors.
The truth is, most of us are brushing our teeth wrong, not for long enough, and forget to change our brush on time. That's because most brands focus on selling flashy gimmicks rather than better brushing. But not Quip. So, what makes Quip so different? For starters, Quip is an electric toothbrush that's a fraction of the cost of bulkier brushes, while still packaging just the right amount of vibrations to help clean your teeth. Quip's built-in timer helps you clean for the dentist's recommended 2 minutes with guiding pulses that remind you when to switch sides. Next, Quip subscription plans are for your health, not just convenience. They send you new brush heads on a dentist-recommended 3-month schedule for just $5, including free shipping worldwide. Quip also comes with a mount that suctions right to your mirror that you can also use as a cover for hygienic travel wherever you take your teeth. And finally, everyone loves Quip. They were on Oprah's O-List, named one of Time's best inventions, and is the first subscription electric toothbrush accepted by the American Dental Association. Plus, they're backed by a network of over 20,000 dentists and hygienists, as well as hundreds of thousands of happy brushers who use Quip every day. Quip starts at just $25, and if you go to getquip.com/MMMF right now, you'll get your first refill pack free with a Quip electric toothbrush. That's your first refill pack free. Getquip.com/MMMF. That's getquip.com/MMMF.
Hey guys, it's Jack Manning from The Lady Gang, and I am sitting here with true crime TV producer and my best friend, Alexis Linkletter, and we are so excited that we are finally launching our true crime podcast called The First Degree right here on Podcast One.
And each week, we are going to bring you the craziest true crime stories and talk to the people who are 1 degree away from each of these crazy events.
And we've dragged crime journalist Billy Jensen along for the ride, and he can't get rid of us.
Join us on The First Degree every Wednesday on podcast1.com and the PC One app.
Also remember to rate and review.
This program contains graphic violence and sexual situations. Viewer discretion is advised. In 1977, Rodney Alcala has added 18-year-old Jill Barcombe to the list of victims that he has brutally raped, strangled, and killed.
He is absolutely the worst of the worst, no question about it. If he's strangling them almost to death and then letting them recover and revive and then doing it again, that's just classical sadism. He's enjoying this.
No, please.
This is what makes him feel powerful.
No!
In the fall of 1977, Rodney Alcala gets a job at one of the biggest newspapers in the country. He uses a fake resume, but his real name. So now he's typesetting for a newspaper that will soon be reporting on his crimes. How ironic is that?
Here's a headline for tomorrow. They found another dead girl. This one was killed in her own apartment, and the cops have no leads. Scary, huh?
It's scary. Hope they catch this guy soon.
Yeah, me too. Hey, you want to get drinks again tonight?
You got it.
All right.
Rodney's next victim is 27-year-old Georgia Wixted. In December of 1977, her body is found in her bedroom. She has been raped and savagely attacked with a claw hammer. Alcala's employer, the Los Angeles Times, frequently runs headlines about the murders of young women. Their killer's calling card is leaving the victims' bodies on hillsides in the canyons above L.A. A 30-person police task force is set up to find the killer, who becomes known as the Hillside Strangler.
Because of the Hillside Strangler murders, police were interviewing all the sex offenders in the area, and that included Rodney Alcala. But his luck held up, because police had no idea that they were talking to a man who was guilty of another set of murders.
Be very careful of the smooth talkers, because they're the best manipulators. And if they're real smooth, that could be a good indication that they've got something to hide or they are hiding something.
Does the name Lauren Wagner ring a bell?
No, not at all.
Generally, the truth is the truth, and you get a sense when you hear it.
Can you recall your whereabouts from the night of December 13th?
And if somebody overtruths, you better be careful because they're probably lying.
I don't recall.
Rodney Alcala did indeed kill Jill Barcombe, but authorities won't discover this for years. They will believe that Barcombe was a victim of the Hillside Strangler and not the man they're questioning. No longer considered a suspect, Rodney Alcala is released. This will prove unfortunate for Alcala's next victim, 32-year-old Charlotte Lamb. Her body is found posed in the laundry room of an apartment complex in 1978.
Welcome to the dating game.
It is also during this same year that Rodney is chosen to appear on a popular national television show.
By this point, Rodney Alcala had killed and raped multiple women. He'd been convicted of beating and raping a child. And yet somehow he ended up on a popular game show. How did that happen?
Backstage, the other contestants allege that Alcala's behavior is far from friendly.
So you're an actor?
Yeah, sure am.
And you're appearing on a game show?
Yeah, so?
Wow. What a challenging role.
It's time to meet our first three bachelors, shall we? Bachelor number one is a successful photographer who got his start when his father found him in the darkroom at the age of 13, fully developed. Between takes, you might find him skydiving or motorcycling. Please welcome Rodney Alcala.
He was one of three men. If you watch that show back then, there was a woman who's sitting behind a shield who would ask them questions, they'd give answers, and she'd pick someone to go on a date with at the end of the dating game.
I'm a drama teacher, and I'm going to audition each of you for my private class. Bachelor number one, you're a dirty old man. Take it.
Ooh, come on, over here.
In the 1970s, it wasn't unusual for dating game contestants to ask these really cheesy questions that were full of double entendres.
Contestant Cheryl Bradshaw has no idea that the man with whom she's exchanging playful banter is a murderer and a rapist.
Bachelor number one, I'm serving you for dinner. What are you called? And what do you look like?
I'm called the banana, and I look really good.
Could you be a little more descriptive?
Peel me.
After asking the three bachelors a series of playful questions, it's time for Cheryl to pick her date.
Who will the date be? Will it be bachelor number one, bachelor number two, or bachelor number three? Who gets the date?
When I saw that video and I'm watching, I thought, no, she's not going to pick him.
Well, I like bananas, so I'll pick bachelor number one.
Bachelor number one.
And I thought, oh my God.
Unbeknownst to Cheryl, she has just chosen a sadistic murderer as her date. Will she be the next in a long line of Rodney Alcala's victims?
So I'll take bachelor number one.
Bachelor number one.
Cheryl Bradshaw has just picked Rodney Alcala as her date on the dating game. She has no idea that she has selected a serial killer and that she may be his potential next victim.
Cheryl's instincts tell her that something isn't right with Rodney Alcala after meeting him face to face.
Can I speak to you privately for a moment? There's no way I'm going out with that guy. Something about him gives me the creeps.
She was smart enough not to ever go on the date with him because, in her words, he creeped her out.
Rejected, Rodney goes back on the prowl. In February 1979, Alcala picks up 15-year-old hitchhiker Monique Hoyt. After spending the night at Rodney's house, they take a trip the next day.
He took her up into the mountains under the ruse, which he used more than once, of taking photographs because he was an amateur photographer.
Very nice. How about a few silly ones now?
Okay.
Pull your shirt up over your face. Excellent.
Alcala proceeds to rape the unconscious Monique Hoyt. When she awakens, she finds herself bound and Rodney sobbing.
And he started to cry, which is the only evidence we have that Rodney Alcala ever had any emotion, ever.
The streetwise Monique thinks fast in an attempt to survive.
Rodney, are you okay? You know, I had a lot of fun at your place last night. Could I stay there again? I think it'd be really nice if we could hang out there.
Yeah, it would be.
And that is the one person that managed to talk Rodney Alcala out of murdering her.
Monique Hoyt was only 15 years old, but she was really smart and found a way to bond with Rodney Alcala and gain his confidence. He unties her, and then they get in his car, and she waits for her chance to escape. And then it comes.
Gotta use the John. I'll be right back.
No problem. I'll wait here.
Detectives show Monique Hoyt photos of men matching the description of her assailant. She immediately recognizes Rodney Alcala. Rodney is arrested while Monique is taken to the hospital and treated for her injuries.
Rodney Alcala's mother feels like a terrible mistake has been made, so she posts his bond. And on March 16, 1979, he's freed from jail, waiting for his trial that September. So now he's on the streets and able to find more victims.
Out on bail, Rodney Alcala looks for his next victim, 21-year-old Jill Parenteau of Burbank, California.
Hey, ladies. Can I buy you a drink?
No, thanks. We're good. We're actually waiting for people.
Well, how about meeting me? You ever met a freelance photographer before?
Some other time, okay?
Suit yourselves.
Alcala discovers where Jill lives. One night in June, she returns home from a date. It will be the last thing she ever does.
Rodney Alcala was incredibly sadistic to his victims. He would choke them until they'd lose consciousness. And then, when they woke back up, he'd do it again.
Jill is found the next day. Like Alcala's other victims, her body has been posed. Police have few clues.
She was at the end of her bed. She was naked. She was propped up with her arms underneath her and pillows underneath her to prop up her breasts.
Alcala prowls the beaches of Southern California to find potential prey. On June 20th, 1979, he comes across 12-year-old Robin Samso and her friend, Bridget Wilvert, at Huntington Beach.
Would you girls mind if I take your picture? It's for a photo class.
Sure, why not?
Mother of Robin Samso, Marianne Connolly.
When you say the word sweet, Robin was sweet. I don't think there was anybody that ever said a bad thing about her.
Bridget's neighbor, Jackie Young, is also at the beach, and what she sees makes her suspicious.
Hey, Ms. Young. Me and Robin are just getting our picture taken for a photo class.
You know, I don't really think that's a good idea, because you shouldn't really talk to strangers. Why don't you come with me, and I'll take you back to your place, okay?
He supposedly left, but obviously he didn't, because he followed Robin. Robin had to go to her classes, so she left the beach. And she borrowed Bridget's bike to go to class or she wouldn't be late.
What happens next is unknown.
Call me tomorrow, Robin.
Robin never makes it to her ballet class.
And that's the day she was taken.
Somewhere between leaving her house, Rodney saw her, almost certainly followed her, got her to get into the car, and she'd seen him from the beach, offered to give her a ride.
And I called the police and told them, I said, my daughter's missing. And they told me that they couldn't take a report for 24 hours. So by the next morning, they declared it a kidnapping.
Robin's friend, Bridget, gives a police sketch artist a description of the photographer on the beach. The sketch is widely distributed.
He murdered her and he dumped her body up in the hills above Altadena. She was scavenged by animals. Her bones weren't found for a couple of weeks. There's virtually nothing left of her by the time she was actually found.
Dispatch, we got a body near Marker 11 off Santa Anita Canyon Road.
Robin's mother, Marianne, is given the devastating news.
And Sergeant Jenkins came in and he said, we found Robin. I said, I grabbed my purse. I said, okay, let's go. He says, where do you think you're going? I said, go see Robin. He says,
why don't you take a seat?
No, I don't want to sit. I want to see your body.
I'm sorry, ma'am. We can't do that.
That's my daughter. Why not?
Because it took us 3 days to identify her body.
And I got angry. I got so mad. I said, 3 days? I said, how many little girls with long blonde hair disappear in California that took you 3 days? And he said,
there was no hair.
Nobody could understand that somebody could actually do something like this.
When Robin disappeared, it was a huge media event in Southern California, and Rodney's probation officer out in Riverside saw this composite, looked at it, and went, you know what? That's our guy.
I'm calling about a composite poster that's been distributed. It looks like a guy who used to be on my caseload. He had a thing for cameras and little girls. I think he could be your man. His name is Rodney Alcala.
It's all beginning to close in on Rodney Alcala.
On July 24th, 1979, police arrest Rodney Alcala at the Monterey Park house he shares with his mother. Bail is set at $250,000, which is too high for his mother to pay. Will police finally get the evidence to prosecute him? Or will he slip through their hands yet again? It's 1979. After a killing spree that's lasted almost 8 years, Rodney Alcala is finally behind bars and charged with the murder of 12-year-old Robin Samso.
He was put in a room so that his sister could come in and talk to him. And they recorded what was going on in that conversation.
A storage unit?
It's in Seattle. Cops don't know about it. I need a favor, Chrissy. Get that stuff out of there. Clear it out.
Police are monitoring Rodney Alcala's communication with his sister, and they hear them talk about a storage locker. Rodney wants his sister to go take something out of that locker before police get there. What is he trying to hide?
Inside, they find dozens of photos. They also discover a pouch full of jewelry and earrings.
And these turned out to be Rodney Alcala's trophies from his murders.
Dozens of pieces of jewelry. Every one of those is a memento of some victim someplace. And from that, we found Robin Samso's earrings, the ones that she was wearing.
Rodney Alcala pleads not guilty to the murder of Robin Samso. A jury trial convicts him in 1980, but the verdict is overturned on a technicality. He remains behind bars for years, and a retrial occurs in 1986. The guilty verdict is thrown out on a different technicality, but as before, he stays in prison.
Because of appeals, as well as problems with witnesses and evidence, there are several trials. This means that Rodney Alcala's victims' families had to hear this horrifying testimony again and again and again. They were in hell.
I wouldn't wish this on my worst enemy. It's one thing even losing a child, but to keep reliving it for 35 years is...
In 2010, after DNA technology links Alcala to numerous murder cases, prosecutors from Orange and L.A. counties hold a joint trial.
We started getting DNA hits in Los Angeles County.
DNA found at 4 different crime scenes of murdered women in the 1970s matches that of Rodney Alcala.
For years, Rodney Alcala was able to game the system, but DNA evidence finally caught up with his crimes, and prosecutors used it against him.
The Los Angeles County cases are 18-year-old Jill Barcombe, 27-year-old Georgia Wixted, 32-year-old Charlotte Lamb, and 21-year-old Jill Parenteau. All were raped and murdered by Alcala. Almost 30 years after his first conviction in the Robin Samso case, Rodney Alcala stands trial for the murder of both her and the 4 other victims connected by his DNA. He decides to act as his own attorney.
I had a hard time really containing myself because he'd look at me and he'd have this grin on his face. It was the most evil thing I've ever seen, you know, and he enjoyed it. He enjoyed every minute of it.
The trial is televised and draws national media attention.
Actress Charlize Theron is researching a role and shows up to one day of his trial. but she disguises herself and keeps a low profile because she doesn't want anybody to know that she's there, especially not the jury.
We the jury.
After less than 2 days of deliberation, the jury finds Alcala guilty of all five murders.
To be death.
Alcala is sentenced to death. However, since resuming capital punishment in 1978, the state of California has only carried out a handful of executions. With a massive backlog of prisoners on death row, Rodney Alcala will likely spend the rest of his life in prison. In 2012, Alcala confesses to the two New York murders he committed, Cornelia Crilly in 1971 and Ellen Hover in 1977. To this day, police are still connecting Rodney Alcala to many cold cases using the 100-plus photographs that were found in his Seattle storage locker.
A lot of these women, we have no idea what happened to them. All we know is they were in a vulnerable position, and Rodney Alcala uses charms to talk them into going someplace that he could have his way with them. I mean, since he was convicted for this, we have cleared case after case after case because of those photographs.
Over 21 women are accounted for through the photos, while other women and children are recognized by families as loved ones who have been confirmed missing for years.
Some authorities believe that Rodney Alcala had murdered up to 130 girls and women. We may never know the scope of what he did.
Who else did you murder, and where are the bodies? That would be my question, is who else is out there, where are they, and please can you give the family some peace? That's what I would say to him.
Alcala's last victim, Robin Samso, is memorialized on a plaque at Huntington Beach near the site of her 1979 abduction.
They asked me, they said, what do you want to say on a plaque? I said, you can say anything you want about Robin, but I don't want his name mentioned on there. He's got no place on that plaque. That's her plaque.
I'm in awe of these victims that survived and these families that have survived all those years trying to hold him accountable for his actions. They are courageous, loving people who keep their loved ones close to their hearts. And I just hope they find some peace in the closure through these trials that they had not had, thanks to him, for decades.
That concludes this episode of Murder Made Me Famous. Don't forget to go to Reels.com, that's Reelz.com, for clips, extras, and more. And check out new episodes every Saturday on the Reels channel. Don't forget to subscribe on PodcastOne.com, the Podcast One app, and Apple Podcasts. One third of all murder cases in America remain open.
He had told me that if I opened my eyes, he would slit my throat.
Each one is called a cold case.
The DNA evidence taken from the victim was a match. The linen rapist was at it again.
Based on the hit A&E television program.
A phone call is placed, one that changes a family's life forever.
Cold Case Files, the podcast.
If you could see the fire in his eyes, he screamed at me, "You want it? Get your tape recorder out."
Download new episodes every Tuesday on PodcastOne.com, the Podcast One app, or Apple Podcasts.